Summary. Chapter 4. Vocabulary. Falsehood. Deception. Patch. Blindfold tie. Slobbering. Grunt. Spill. Vendor. Obituary. Set out. Hostility. Lead somebody into a trap. Steep. Ridge. Gash. Middle of nowhere. To regain consciousness. To bury.
You're right. The old man Thomas Effing is a strange character. He seems to be blind, and he's sitting in a wheelchair.
But that's not strange. He's just a very miserable, unhappy guy.
True. But it is his character that is difficult to understand.
So much of his character was built on falsehood and deception. It was nearly impossible to know when he was telling the truth. He loved to trick the world with his sudden experiments and inspiration, and of all the stunts he pulled, the one he liked best was playing dead.
Marco finds out that much of him is built on falsehood and deception. Marco is not even sure if Effing is really blind or if it's just a trick. Remember, one day he wears black patches over his eyes, another day he wears normal glasses, and sometimes he has a black blindfold tied around his head. This does not make any sense, and it points to the fact that Effing is really a difficult person. And just think of his dinner manners.
Ooh, he lets out all kinds of slobbering grunts and spills. Very disgusting. At the beginning, Marco doesn't know how difficult this old man is. He moves into Effing's apartment and meets Mrs. Hume, Effing's nurse and housekeeper, who also lives there. She's a nice woman who helps Marco get used to his new job and the old man.
I felt I had an ally in this woman, and that served as a kind of protection against whatever strange thing was about to happen.
Marco has to read to Effing in the afternoons, and if the weather is nice, he takes him out for walks.
The first books they read are all travel books. Marco likes them and enjoys reading those books himself.
Yes, the daily reading sessions are no problem for him, but the walks are not as easy.
Marco doesn't have any troubles with the wheelchair. Effing is light, and Marco quickly learns how to move it. The difficult thing is that the old man asks Marco to describe the things he sees on their walks. Remember, Effing is blind.
This is a difficult task for Marco. He has to learn a completely new way of looking at the world around him. He can't generalize too much because then Effing cannot imagine the objects, but he also has to be careful not to be too detailed. Then Effing cannot follow his descriptions. He has to find the essence of an object and leave room for Effing's imagination.
It took me weeks of hard work to simplify my sentences, to learn how to separate the extraneous from the essential. I discovered that the more air I left around a thing, the happier the results, for that allowed Effing to do the crucial work on his own, to construct an image on the basis of a few hints, to feel his own mind traveling toward the thing I was describing for him.
Thomas Effing acts very differently when they are on their walks. He is polite when talking to neighbors and vendors, and he even can behave when they have a cup of tea somewhere.
This is another aspect of his strange and difficult character. It seems like he wants to disgust Marco and Mrs. Hume when they are having lunch or dinner together. In public, he knows how to act.
I don't know. But things get stranger. One day, they stop reading travel books, and Marco has to read the New York Times to Effing for 1 or 2 weeks. It takes him some time to understand that Effing is especially interested in the obituaries.
This is a weird old man.
Well, yes, but it somehow makes sense once he tells Marco that he wants him to help him write his obituary. He knows that he will die soon.
But why does he want to write it himself? Normally, this is something other people do for you once you're dead.
That's exactly what Marco asks him, too. And Efim reveals to Marco that he has never told anyone the story of his life. Nobody knows that he changed his name after people thought he was dead. And over the years, he has invented too many different stories of his life. Now he wants to tell the truth.
Changed his name? He was dead? Can we start at the beginning?
Well, Efim was once called Julian Barber. He was a famous American painter until he disappeared, and he used to know Ralph Albert Blakelock.
I know Blakelock. He was an American painter of romantic and subjective landscapes of the Western wilderness.
Wow, I'm impressed. Marco didn't know that. So Efim sends him to the Brooklyn Museum to look at Blakelock's painting, Moonlight. He is not allowed to talk to anyone on the way, and he has to close his eyes while he is on the train. In that way, his eyes get used to the darkness, and it becomes sensitive to colors and light effects. Efim asks him to look at the painting for more than an hour.
That's a hard task, but did you realize we're talking about the moon again? The moon can also be seen in the painting.
Oh, really, Einstein? Why should a painting otherwise be called Moonlight?
There is a big moon. It is a perfectly round moon in the middle of the painting. It illuminates the sky, a lake, a large tree, and some Indians sitting around a campfire. And there is another person, separate from the others, sitting on a horse.
At first, Marco is a bit disappointed because the painting is a rather small and very calm landscape painting. He thought it would be more dramatic. But then he looks longer at it, and suddenly he realizes that the humans are very small in contrast to the landscape. The moon powerfully illuminates the scene, and the sky and the lake have the same greenish color.
But that's not possible. How can the sky have the same color as a lake?
True. Marco asks himself the same question. He finally understands that Blakelock wanted to show a harmonious picture of what Indian life was like before the whites came and destroyed their life.
That makes sense. The painting was painted in 1885, a time when white people had almost destroyed Indian life.
Exactly. Blakelock's painting shows a lost American idol.
And Efim? What does he say about it?
Nothing. He doesn't talk about it to Marco. The next day, he starts telling him the story of his life. Marco has to write everything down into a notebook.
So, what's the story of his life?
Well, it's not that easy. So many things happened to Efim. Julian Barber.
His name was Julian Barber. Okay, I got that. And he wanted to be a painter after he met Nikola Tesla.
Yes, Nikola Tesla was a famous inventor around the turn of the century. The young Julian Barber first saw him in 1893, and he was very impressed by him. One day, Tesla looked right through him, and Barber understood that he was responsible for his own life. After that, he became a painter. He inherited his father's money, and so he did not have any money problems.
Then, Thomas Moran, another American painter of landscapes, gave him the idea of traveling into the Western wilderness.
Barber was already married unhappily for 3 years, and maybe this influenced his decision to travel west with a friend, Edward Byrne. In April 1916, they set out to Salt Lake City.
They found a guide who agreed to take them into the wilderness. They did not really trust this man, but it was the only chance they had.
The guide's name was Jack Scoresby, and he had a bad character. He could not understand what these two guys from the East wanted to do in the desert. And then Julian Barber beat him in the card game Blackjack.
Yep, his hostility grew, and Jack Scoresby led them into a trap. He knew that they could not ride as well as him, so he guided them onto a steep hill.
Edward Byrne could not control his horse anymore and fell down the ridge. He was seriously wounded.
Seriously wounded? The man was half dead. His arms and legs were broken, and he had a large bleeding gash below his ribs. It was obvious that he had no chance to survive in the wilderness, but he could not be carried on the horse either.
That's why Jack wanted to kill him right away, but Julian stopped him. So Jack left Julian and the dying Byrne behind in the middle of nowhere.
Edward Byrne died some days later. He never regained consciousness. Barber buried him and then he was entirely alone in the wilderness.
He had no orientation, no guide, and his friend had just died.
That's how it happened, Fogg. You're the first person I've ever told this to. I started to scream, and after that I just let myself be crazy.
It was a very desperate situation. He also had to survive on his own in the wilderness. In a way, this parallels Marco's own story of living as a homeless person in Central Park.
Summary, Chapter 5. Vocabulary. Food supplies. Brook. Change of mood. Hallucinate. Peace of mind. Solitude. Urge. Restriction. Canvas. Simple-minded. Deformed. Smart aleck. To be engaged in. Stove. Saddlebags. Bonds. Precarious. Gambling. Lamp post. Bill. Break loose. To cremate.
After Burns' death, Julian Barber got lost in the canyon. He began to realize that he could never go back to his old life. He was too ashamed of what had happened, and he thought that it was better if people believed him to be dead, too.
He wandered around screaming and nearly went mad. Then he ran out of food and water, and Julian Barber thought it was his time to die. He found a cave that seemed to be a good place to die.
But Barber was lucky. The cave was furnished, and there were food supplies as well.
Well, and there was a dead man lying in a bed, too.
The man was shot in the head. But I'm sure that Julian Barber didn't really care. I mean, one moment earlier he was ready to die, and now there was a chance of surviving.
That's true, and indeed Barber decided to take the man's place. He concluded that the man must have been some kind of hermit, and not too many people might come looking for him. He buried him, and when looking for a good place to do that, he even came across a brook close to the cave. So his water supplies were also saved.
Julian Barber started his new life as a hermit after that. He went through changes of mood. Sometimes he felt lonely. He even started to hallucinate and killed his donkey. But finally, he found his peace of mind in this solitude.
Then he felt the urge to paint again. And as his art supplies were still there, he started to paint. The extreme situation he was in influenced his work, and he found a completely new quality of art. He had to deal with two restrictions. First, he understood that nobody would ever see his painting. Knowing that he wasn't painting for an audience enabled him to paint without restrictions. Second, his supplies were limited, and once his canvases were full and the colors were gone, he knew he would have to stop.
Art became a way of understanding the world for Julian Barber, and his paintings got a raw and energetic quality.
The true purpose of art was not to create beautiful objects, he discovered. It was a method of understanding, a way of penetrating the world and finding one's place in it.
Actually, I find it hard to imagine these paintings, but I think of them as being a bit crazy. Effing describes them to Marco as a whirl of forms and light. Imagine, after he ran out of canvases, he started to paint on the furniture, and finally even on the walls of the cave, similar to old cultures.
Well, many artists have had some notion of madness, don't you think?
True, and once he had no more colors, he started to write.
Quite romantic. Winter came, life slowed down, and Barber sat in his cave, writing.
But you can't live like that forever. And it was obvious that life would not go on like this. In March, Julian had his first visitor. George Ugly Mouth was a friendly, simple-minded Indian with a deformed face.
Just as the name says.
Right, Mr. Smart Aleck. The important thing for Barbara was that he could now find out something about the dead man who had lived in the cave before. And it was also a test if George would take him to be this man.
Well, Barbara learned that the man's name had been Tom and that apparently he had been engaged in illegal activities with the so-called Gresham brothers.
This sounds so much like a Western movie.
Yep. Barbara concluded that the Gresham brothers must have killed Tom.
And he also found out that they were going to come back sooner or later. This was quite disturbing for Julian Barber. After that, he lost his peace of mind and worried about the brothers all the time. He was afraid and started to work out a plan.
He stopped using his stove and didn't sleep in the cave anymore because he was afraid they might surprise him at night.
One day, the brothers finally came. Barbara killed them and found their saddlebags packed with money.
Imagine, $20,000 and bonds worth $10,000 and stolen jewelry. So much money.
It meant for Julian that his time in the cave was up. He took the money and left on the horses of the brothers. After a couple of days, he came to the town of Bluff, and from there he traveled to San Francisco to start a new life.
Do you believe all of this? I mean, it really does sound like a good Western movie.
Well, not even Marco is sure if Effing is telling him the truth, but I think it is a fascinating story nevertheless. Don't you agree?
True. It doesn't really matter. Once Julian Barber came to San Francisco, he invented a new identity and became Thomas Effing.
The name Thomas referring to his painter friend Thomas Moran, and also to Tom, the dead man from the cave. And effing, that's funny, actually. He thought of the word fucking.
Fucking? Who would want to call himself that?
It's a pun. You know that we normally write only F-ing, pronounced effing, and you might understand it as he was Thomas Effing, the man who had fucked his life?
If something like that happened to me, I might think of a similar name. Living through all this makes you probably rather sarcastic. And if you think about what will happen to Thomas Effing, this name serves him quite well.
First of all, everything went well in San Francisco. Effing got rich again and could live as he used to before his trip to Utah. He gave parties and was invited. But then he met a man who used to know him in his past under his former name.
That must have been a shock. But he could talk himself out of the situation. After that, he understood how precarious his situation was. He kept himself away from other people and spent his time in Chinatown with gambling, prostitutes, and opium. Effing lost much money, and then the accident happened.
Accident? It was an attack at night. Somebody knocked him on the head while he was walking home in the dark, steep streets. He rolled down the hill and broke his spine, crushing into a lamppost. That's how he came to sit in a wheelchair.
Effing understood this attack as a kind of punishment. After his recovery, he decided to leave the U.S. and move to Paris in September of 1920.
Well, there is not much more to say about the rest of Effing's life. In Paris, he met the Russian Pavel Shum, who became his friend and companion. In 1939, they moved back to New York City.
Did you realize that all the important events in Julian Barber's or Thomas Effing's life happened in America? Though he spent almost 20 years in France, the course of his life was altered only in the U.S.
Someone being smart again? But you're right.
Thank you. But what happens after Effing has told all these facts about his life to Marco?
Marco writes three different versions of an obituary. One short one, a longer version, and then a very elaborate autobiographical version.
One day, he finds three books by Solomon Barber in his room. Marco then learns from Effing that Solomon Barber is his son and that this poor man has no idea that his father, Thomas Effing, is alive. Both have never seen each other or have had any contact. Solomon is a professor of history. According to what Effing has heard, he is a fat and rather unsuccessful man. Effing wants Marco to send the autobiography to Solomon Barber once he's dead.
Marco cannot see why Thomas Effing thinks that he's going to die soon. It's March 12, 1970, and Effing seems to be in perfect health. He announces that he will die in exactly 2 months on May 12th.
Mark my words. 2 months from today, I'm going to be dead.
Wow. Imagine somebody announcing the date of his death. That's scary.
A bit. But Marco does not really believe it, and life goes on as normal after that. He reads to Effing. They go out for their daily walks.
But not for long. One day, Effing comes up with this crazy plan. He wants to give back the $20,000 he once took from the Gresham brothers.
But he doesn't know where the money came from.
Exactly. He wants to give it to total strangers on the streets of New York.
This man is really a bit crazy. This is a dangerous thing to do in New York City.
I guess that's what Marco thinks, too. But he still agrees to help the old man. They decide to walk around the city for 10 days after dinner time and hand $50 bills to people in the streets.
I wish I'd been a stranger.
Me too. Everything works out fine. They try to give the money to poor people, to people they think who need the money. After 8 evenings, the weather turns bad and they have to make a pause. But finally they can continue.
And they meet Orlando.
Yeah, the young black man who walks the streets with a broken umbrella, pretending that it is raining. After walking together down the street under his umbrella, Orlando gives Effing his umbrella as a present.
A broken umbrella? Well,
yes, but it is more of a joke, I think.
But it turns out to play an important part the next evening. It is a foggy night, and Mrs. Hume and Marco allow Effing only to leave the house with an umbrella.
But Effing secretly takes Orlando's broken umbrella.
Of course, it starts to rain, and Marco cannot stop Effing from getting wet. He breaks loose with his wheelchair and pretends that he doesn't get wet with the umbrella.
There's no rain, he thundered as the rain crashed down on him from all sides, drenching his clothes and pelting him in the face.
Marco understands that Effing wants to die. He wants to get sick. He makes a decision not to stop the old man. They finish their task of giving away the money and go home completely wet.
And Effing does get sick. They come home completely wet, and the next day he comes down with pneumonia. He doesn't want to go to the hospital, and they hire private nurses to take care of him. But Effing slowly gets weaker and weaker. Losing his strength, Marco spends a lot of time with him.
After the day out in the rain, they've developed a closer relationship, and now that Effing cannot leave his bed anymore, it comforts him to have Marco around. He wants to hear his voice and worries about Marco's future, just like he was his own flesh.
Effing develops a tenderness now that he knows he's going to die soon.
Right. He finally dies on May 12th, just as he predicted.
But he hardly makes it. He dies exactly 2 minutes past midnight.
But he still makes it. He is cremated afterwards, and Marco and Mrs. Hume organize his funeral.
Mrs. Hume, her brother Charlie, Kitty, and Marco are the only people at the funeral. They throw the ashes from the Staten Island Ferry into the water right in the middle of the passage when they can see the Statue of Liberty. That's what Effing wanted them to do.
That's symbolic for somebody who had such a strong relationship with New York City.
Well, you said that all important events of Thomas Effing's life took place in America, and he has lived in New York for many years. Of course he felt connected to the city.
What happens to Marco now?
He leaves Effing's apartment, and Mrs. Hume hands him a bag Effing asked her to give to Marco after his death. And imagine what's in the bag.
That's not so difficult. Is it money?
Yep, $7,000.
That's a lot.